Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Another very busy week in the crime arena. We're going to talk today about R. Kelly, obviously the shocking news, but actually not so much shocking news because everyone knew about it but did nothing for over 30 years. And also the continued issues with the Metropolitan Police now in special measures for the very first time since its creation. So let's kick off with R. Kelly. Nazir, obviously your background very much around safeguarding child protection. This was known for a very long time.
More than 30 years. I think the 1990s is when he began his career. And in fact, they actually called him the Pied Piper of R&B. We all know the story of the Pied Piper, you know, so you'd have thought that somebody might have cottoned on. He was surrounded by a coterie of people who just allowed him to do what he wanted to do. He picked on young girls from a very early age in his career. I mean, there were stories in relation to the artist called Aaliyah, for example. She was 15 when he began a relationship, quote unquote, with her. She's now no longer with us, unfortunately. But there were, you know, there were stories about him going back, as I said, the best part of 30 years. And he seemed, as you and I know, to be above it all. Nobody seemed to be particularly interested in him. I think there was something about R&B and hip hop culture that maybe, you know, this is the kind of thing that you just turn a blind eye to. But unfortunately, by doing so, in relation to him specifically, he was unable to just, you know, on an industrial scale, find young girls, abuse young girls, and fulfill his most ridiculous fantasies, his horrific fantasies, actually. And I have no doubt he's damaged numerous lives. And the fact that nobody in the 30-odd years felt able or was able or courageous enough or brave enough, whatever the word is, to speak up about him and earlier than now meant that many, many more women and girls were abused. They could have prevented all of that harm if they'd had the courage to speak up. They chose not to. And finally, he gets his day or days in court. He was sentenced, as you said, to 30 years in jail. He is also facing other charges in relation to child sex images, for example. He is also due to face sexual abuse charges in Illinois, in Minnesota. He told the court that he himself was the victim, or his lawyers did, he himself was the victim of child sexual abuse, which he detailed in his autobiography, how he was raped by a female family member when he was 8 years old. And, you know, he was obviously, that may well be true. I'm not going to say it isn't true, but in no way does it justify the subsequent behavior. You know, the reality is that he has damaged dozens and dozens of lives. And, you know, you've got a history of really, really public abusive relationships. He treated women as a sex object, and young girls in particular. The younger the better, as far as he was concerned.
Yeah, I mean, he was absolutely vile, wasn't he? Let's unpick some of that. So, as you say, sentenced to 30 years, conviction in a federal court of sex trafficking and racketeering. He faced 7 of his accusers in court and convicted on 9 counts, 1 charge of racketeering and 8 counts of violating a law which prohibits trafficking of people across state lines for prosecution. The director of Homeland Security Investigations called the singer a prolific serial predator who utilized his wealth and fame to prey on the young and vulnerable by dangling promises of fame, fortune, and stardom for his own sexual gratification. Now, of course, the element of his status has a huge bearing in relation to this, these crimes. He was tried previously in relation to other offences and,
several times,
acquitted of those.
Yeah, in one case in relation to child abuse videos that were found on his person, after a 6-year investigation and he was the jury could not be sure that the girl on the tape was a minor. She was, you know, and so he was found not guilty in relation to that. But there were, you know, numerous arrests for child sexual abuse images in Florida. There were allegations that he had women in a sex, quote unquote, cult. There were cases back in 2002 in relation to women that he impregnated. He settled those cases out of court, undisclosed sums. He was sued by an intern in 2001. You know, we're talking about somebody who literally has been on the radar of the authorities. Again, it's a credit to the media because it was a documentary.
It was, wasn't it? It was that very famous...
R. Kelly, I think it was called, which two or three years ago, over 6 hour long episodes.
Yeah, released in 2019, Surviving R. Kelly, and that was the catalyst.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame that it requires that. I mean, the police should be doing their job and investigating and encouraging witnesses and victims to come forward. But as it happens, it took until 2019 before this documentary, before they finally decided to file charges against him. In the meantime, of course, he's been abusing women and girls for the best part of 25 years.
It's very interesting that he's been charged with racketeering by the prosecutors. Now, that's usually a charge that's brought about for kind of drug lords. Because what it effectively says is that we have got the man at the top of the circle. We've got
it,
the man.
It also
at the
means
top
you
of
can
the
you
rim.
Can bring in all sorts of evidence that would otherwise be inadmissible. If in a straightforward allegation of, say, rape against one person, it's generally the victim, maybe any witnesses, it might be some digital evidence. But when it comes to when you charge racketeering, as you say, that was brought in to deal with sort of mafia type crimes, you can bring in all sorts of evidence. And that, I think, is why they decided to go with that route, because it was a very complex picture, and to make it as easy as possible for the jury, they were able to bring in all sorts of evidence that otherwise perhaps would be inadmissible.
And it does suggest perhaps that the prosecutors are looking to go after other people who have facilitated this.
You would hope so. I mean, having charged racketeering, which is pretty much saying there's a conspiracy going on, and as you quite rightly pointed out, he was top of the tree. Well, what about the other twigs and branches on that tree? There were people who enabled this abuse. There were people who stood by and allowed it to happen. I mean, there's no particular offense of being a bystander, but there are offenses of being conspirators. There are offenses where people have brought women and girls into his clutches and allowed him to abuse them. So, there clearly is culpability on the part of many others over that three-decade period who, as I said, they need their day in court.
I want to talk a little bit about the whole status and the industry. And let's set this out. So 1991, when the allegations first really kind of surfaced within the media, there was an anonymous tape that was sent to a journalist. And on that anonymous tape, it was 26 minutes and 39 seconds showing Kelly sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl, even going to the stage that he urinated in her mouth. It did lead to the charge in 2002 and a very, very delayed trial in 2008. As you say, it didn't go anywhere. This is a man that during that period of time sold hundreds of millions of albums and produced for very famous singers, the likes of Whitney Houston, Celine Dion, Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber. Do you think the industry itself played a huge role in covering this up because of his status and because of his money?
Well, he's a commercial.
Earnings?
I can't believe that it didn't, Mark. And you will know this from your own experience in Savile and other cases. People, are making money out of R. Kelly. He was a commercial success. It's ridiculous, actually. One of my favorite songs used to be "I Believe I Can Fly," and I can't even begin to even think about that song anymore. He's tarred my memory of great music, I imagine, because of his behavior. But the industry decided that he was worth money, and that money trumps abuse. Money trumps the safety and security of victims and safeguarding of victims, and they allowed him to continue. With somebody of his nature, his manager, his team around him would all have known what was happening. And in many cases, they may well have facilitated some of the abuse. We'll cross that bridge when we come.
Well, certainly some of the witnesses talked in terms of that, didn't they?
Absolutely.
The fact that there were drivers, there were managers who were allowing the girls to come into the place, facilitating it.
It doesn't happen in a vacuum, does it? Somebody like him, they were brought to him on a plate. The victims were brought to him on a plate. And the industry decided we need the multi-millions that he's producing we will tolerate or turn a blind, at least turn a blind eye to what he was doing, and hope that he doesn't get caught. But, you know, the other thing, you know, as we just detailed a moment ago, Mark, there's been a series of civil cases and criminal allegations 20, 30 odd years. Why did they not pull the plug on him earlier? You know, the industry should have said, hang on a minute, he's far more dangerous than you know, the money isn't worth it. But at the end of the day, they decided money trumps all of this.
It's so sad, isn't it? When we look at Savile, so we look at Savile 2012, and we say, you know, that can't happen again. Yet now we've had a man who's continued to earn millions. Yes, he's finally been prosecuted and convicted, but for years he was able to continue. Why are we still today allowing some of these people? It's all about status and money, isn't it? It trumped people's lives. It
absolutely. There are enough. There are 7 billion people on this earth. I think we can find some decent people amongst that group that we can encourage, that will be talented, that we can support, so that they can entertain us. Why do we pick on people like him and allow this guy and allow him to fester and to damage and to destroy as the way that he has done? They could have pulled the plug on him. His producers and his talent team and the people around him could have pulled the plug on him a long time ago and said he is dangerous. Get him out. And actually put their resources behind somebody else, some other artist, and supported them. It just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I imagine he's quite a controlling figure. I imagine he is quite a scary figure to people around him. So I imagine that, you know, from what I've seen of him and some of the things he's said. But that doesn't excuse the fact that the industry allowed this to fester in the way that they have done.
Certainly in relation to some of the accounts, I'm not going to go into any great detail, but the accounts from some of the witnesses talk about the fact how he would slap them, he would choke them, he spat on their faces. Indeed, on one victim, he caused her to put feces around her face. He videotaped it. This is a man who used control as his offending behaviour.
Yeah, absolutely. He had some horrible sadistic elements to what he was doing. I think a psychologist or a psychiatrist would have a field day with him. But he was a very controlling individual, and he deliberately targeted the younger victims because, of course, they are the most vulnerable. And, you know, that's the thing that really irks me about the industry and the people around him, is that, in the main, he was selecting young girls, and they needed protection, and they decided, no, we won't protect them, we'll protect him. I just find that bewildering.
There were certainly allegations in relation to offences against young males as well.
Yes, that's true.
Young girls. What I find interesting in this, and you're far better placed than me to comment, is what do you think this had about culture and about ethnicity? So the majority of his victims were black, inner city, young girls, predominantly from the Chicago area.
I think you put your finger on it, really. I mean, we would have a similar issue in relation to white girls and grooming gangs. That there are a sector of society that is absolutely ignored, that is just not listened to. And we had in this particular case, these young black girls came from backgrounds. It was, you know, leave it to the white. The mainly white policing authorities weren't particularly interested in them as victims. Didn't put things in place to protect them, provide them with support, and allow them in many respects to abuse. He could act with impunity because they weren't white. I imagine if, you know, very early on he'd been caught abusing some white girls, that the authorities might have moved in a bit faster. And that's that's an element of racism in the system, which, you know, we know exists. And these girls, because they were black, were simply allowed to fester.
And it's such a, I've been going around the country giving these talks for hunting killers, and one of the things that I always talk about is the value of life. And when you look at certain other crimes, particularly the misogyny around the Yorkshire Ripper, and also, you know, some of the more recent cases, it's still so sad that the colour of your skin determines the value of your life.
Yeah. I couldn't put it better than you've done. There's a pecking order, and there are certain people, class, race, maybe where you were schooled, you know, what part of society you're a part of. They determine whether you're going to be a victim or not, and they determine also whether you're going to be a perpetrator or not. And the victims who come from the lowest classes are often from minority backgrounds. The people that might come from care homes or from broken families, they are left to suffer because the authorities think it's too difficult to deal with them, or simply just turn a blind eye to the abuse that they're suffering. It really it depresses me, actually, Mark, that this is continuing. Because, you know, R. Kelly's not the first, and he's not the last by some distance. We're going to talk about others, I'm sure, on these podcasts in the future. But why is it that he was allowed to get away with it for as long as he got away with it? And now, yes, he's got 30 years in prison, and he'll probably see out the rest of his life in prison. But how many women and girls, and boys for that matter, have been abused, whose lives have been damaged and destroyed because nobody thought to stop him?
I wonder how many of those people actually have a conscience and now, as a result of this, look back and think to themselves, do you know what? I could have stopped this. Or do they just bury their head?
No, I mean, some of them obviously contributed to the documentaries that eventually brought this to light. But it took them a long time. You know, the thing about the industry and the creative industries, as much as any other, is that you're wondering, hang on a minute, is my career worth speaking up? You know,
What's the impact on me? What's the impact
exactly.
on me?
They think about that, and they hope that somebody else will do the right thing.
Yeah,
you know, because if I said something, you know, at the end of the day, I'm my musical career or entertainment career is gone. You know, if I'm seen to be accusing somebody that's as powerful as he was, so there are lots of complexities to this. But you know, as I said, we've said before, the bystander has a very important role to play. Sometimes the victim, a lot of the time, the victims don't feel able to speak up. And when it's powerful people like Kelly, that's even more likely. Therefore, the bystander, the person in the studio, the person that's in the hotel, the person that heard and saw something, they have a responsibility. And I always say safeguarding is everybody's business. And you know, you just by speaking up 20, 30 years ago, somebody could have saved many, many lives.
You alluded to it at the very beginning. Let's just talk a little bit about really what I think is probably the most significant piece of evidence against it that was just completely ignored by the industry, by indeed by everybody. So R. Kelly marries Aaliyah when she was just 15 years old. He was 27. He wanted to use that marriage to protect himself against criminal charges because he basically said, look, I've been in such a relationship with this young girl. It was annulled by the family, and sadly that she died in a plane crash in 2001, aged 22. But one of the shocking things about that is that when they looked at the evidence in relation to it, it clearly showed that he had been in a sexual relationship with her since she was 13 or 14, got married when she was 15 through using false identification and documentation. But everybody knew how old she was.
Yeah, absolutely. Tour managers knew. They later testified that, in fact, they'd obtained a fake ID for Aaliyah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the people went out of their way to ensure that he could abuse this young girl. Tragic loss of a really talented singer, actually, Aaliyah. I remember her abilities were extraordinary back in the late 90s. She was abused, she was groomed, she was selected, she was raped by him for many, many years. People facilitated it, you know, as we said a moment ago, they got false documentation to enable him to marry her. They pretended that she was 18 when she was not. She was 15 at the time they married. This was well known in the industry. This was well known in people around him, but they tolerated him because he was bringing in the big bucks.
Yeah.
Money trumps all of that. And that's the thing I can't get my head around, is they're watching a child being abused. And you know, and I know, predators, child sexual predators, don't stick to one victim. You know, so who knows how many other victims there were at that time. They simply turn a blind eye because they were getting money in their back pockets as a result of his quote-unquote success. And I just can't tolerate that. I think we've got to have a good look at ourselves as to whether or not we should question whether or not we did the right thing. And many people in R. Kelly's orbit did not do the right thing.
No, they covered. I mean, I don't know much Latin, although I did learn Latin at school. But radix malorum est cupiditas, the love of money is the root of all evil. I mean, you know, we've talked about it before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again. It eats away. It's one of those elements that has such a controlling aspect. And when you have to decide between money and life, it is amazing now to people when it doesn't relate to them. They go, well, let's just carry on because, you know, we can.
Maybe because you and I are different. I don't think we are. I think we are the bulk. We are the vast majority. We'd have looked into the eyes of Aaliyah and the other victims and thought, actually, my money's not that important.
No.
You know, that her safety, security is far more important. There were others who didn't think that way.
But I equate it, and I say this to everybody that I deal with. You know, I always put myself in the position of being a parent or being, you know, being my own children or my own parents. And I think, you know, how would I want them to be treated? So when I establish that she's 15 years old, you know, what do I do about that? You know, I stop it, don't I? I immediately stop it. I do everything I can to stop it. And then I vote with my feet and say, do you know what? Because for some of those, I understand there's only a certain amount they can do. They go to the authorities, they send something and nothing happens. But you then don't carry on. You cannot carry on, facilitate that. And I just think, you know, the morality of some of these people today raises such a concern for me.
It's really questionable because, you know, as you say, it doesn't have to be not your child. It is somebody's child. Yeah. And I think that... as I say, I can't do the Latin that you did, but money did trump the safety and security of children. And I'm sorry, but that's unforgivable.
So he's due R. Kelly to go back to court, federal court in August, where he faces further charges, this time in relation to possession of child sexual abuse images. Of course, we've now heard a considerable amount of evidence in relation to that. I note that during the trial, when the recordings were played, he sat there and refused to put his headphones on. He has previously been acquitted in relation to charges of child sexual abuse images. But of course, this time now, I think the evidence is pretty compelling.
Oh, it's damning. Yeah. I hope we've seen the last of him. You know, the other day I was thinking about growing up in the 70s and Gary Glitter songs. I don't listen to them anymore. I don't listen to R. Kelly songs anymore. These people, we grew up with, I imagine, and we certainly thought they were entertaining, but there's nothing at all entertaining about what they did.
What do you think it is about the music and entertainment industry?
It attracts young people and very vulnerable people. And you don't have to be, and you become part of a quote-unquote gang when you are supportive of a fan. Going back years and years, you know, we have the concept of a groupie. Remember that? The idea that young people would hang around, not so young, stage doors and all the rest of it. And there was obviously a significant culture around that kind of thing, which I think is massively frowned upon now. But it was very much the de rigueur, from growing up, my years. And people, again, turned a blind eye to it. It was almost seen as part of the industry. But actually, no, it shouldn't be. And I'm hopeful it's less tolerant. People are less tolerant of it now than they ever were.
Do you think it's still a problem, though? Do you still think within the...
Of course it is. Yeah. I mean, come on. You look at some of these stars, quote-unquote, and you look online at these young girls and boys, for that matter, who talk about they would give their whole lives to be in the same circle or the same room as this particular individual. If the individual was an abusive kind of person, well, you can rest assured that they'd make it happen. So, the entertainment industry is less dangerous than it was, I imagine, because of all the things that we've just talked about. But it's still very dangerous to many young, vulnerable people.
And of course, in the UK, we had the Lost Prophets singer Ian Watkins convicted and jailed for 35 years, a string of child sexual abuse. I mean, that's something that I became involved in because I had a source giving me some information. I mean, even to the degree of a rape of a baby. I mean,
no, it was quite horrific. He wanted the mother to give birth to a baby so he could rape it. I mean, does the industry make them that way? No, they are that way. They just happen to find their way. Predators do this, don't they? I mean, you know this. Predators will find, you know, the sexual predators, particularly those involving children, will find an employment or a industry or a way of being able to attract and enable them to get close to victims. And they live their whole life to do that. So, the Lost Prophets guy, we can endlessly list them. These predators spend their whole lives looking for victims, and their career is just a means by which they can find them.
And of course, if you can surround yourself by the victims, as all offences are, you know, access and opportunity is afforded in abundance.
Yeah, and we badly as a society have ignored the voices of these victims and almost said to them, we blame them often, you know, well, how dare you? Why do you get in the hotel room with him? You know, why do you get in the car with him?
Why are we dressed like that?
Exactly. We blame the victims when, in fact, the blame entirely lies with the abuser.
So let's move on. R. Kelly, you were going to jail for a very long time. You should have been there a very long time ago, but thankfully, at least the justice system has finally caught up with you. And I hope that you die in jail. Let's move on to special measures and the Metropolitan Police. I mean, this is kind of, it's become a bit of a stock conversation for us on here because, of course, so many of the cases that have come up recently have involved the Metropolitan Police. We were made aware this week that the Metropolitan Police, as well as almost one in seven police forces, which includes Cleveland, Greater Manchester, Gloucestershire, Staffordshire and Wiltshire, are all in special measures. That's kind of a terminology that's been put to it. They would refer to it, the HMIC, Her Majesty's Inspector Constabularies, who are responsible for doing those reviews, have called it an engagement process. Bottom line is, there's trouble.
Oh, 100%. They've reached the stage where they are perceived as being unfit for purpose. And their work, their actions, their strategies, their plans have been monitored in real time in order to see that improvement results. You can't do any, the only thing you can do is close down a police force. That's never happened. So the next thing to do is to put them in special measures that people need to understand and appreciate. I think you and I should feel a little bit vindicated by what HMRC have done, because we've been critical of the Met in particular over the last year or so. In the way that they have responded to a catalogue of disasters. The commissioner has gone, a former commissioner. The current conversation is about a new commissioner. The point is, though, that the force has lost, in many respects, the confidence of the citizens of London. And you've quite rightly pointed out that's not alone. Greater Manchester, Cleveland, Gloucestershire, you know, these are not small forces. The citizens of all of those areas require a police force that's fit to do the work that they're paid to do. And there are serious concerns about the way the police are engaging in those areas. And, I'm quite depressed about it, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the officers that I grew up with and you grew up with are no longer there anymore. And they would feel, would they not, ashamed that the force that they built up over 20, 30 years of service is now treated or seen in such contempt by so many.
The Metropolitan Police lost 21,000 officers. It's obviously on a massive recruit to try and bring them back. The biggest problem, of course, is that you lose experience.
You lose 500,000 years of experience. You can't replace it with people out of police academy or police school, whatever it's called these days, College of Policing. You can't do that. You can't replace that. You can't replace experience. Additionally, morale is low. You will know this from people you've spoken to. I know as well. Morale is low. So even those that are in the force who've been there for a long time wonder about whether they're doing the right thing. Please, you are doing the right thing. We desperately need your experience. But additionally, there's accusations. The Met are being accused by other Southeast forces of taking their staff as well. So Surrey and Sussex, and
well, they get benefits, don't they?
Kent,
they get
exactly. So the Met, in order to meet their target for recruitment, are taking officers from these other areas, who then, of course, have to start again to try and recruit for them. It's an endless cycle, and you could put it down to the last 10 years of cuts. We can't replace 10 years of cuts and overnight. It'll take maybe a decade to get us back to the levels of experience that we lost. And the Met Police, you know, regardless of who ends up leading it, I've said this. I think it's just too big. You know, it just can't function the way it can. I mean, I sat down with, I won't say who, with very senior leaders in government and others. And I said to them, that, you know, the Met needs to be maybe three or four forces. You know, a North London, a South London, a Central London, maybe take away all the national responsibilities, terrorism, etc. Give it to the National Crime Agency or set up a special force. The City of London has its own little force, doesn't it? Its own commissioner, and you don't hear many bad things about the City of London. I think it's unmanageable, the Met, in its current size. It probably needs four chief constables, or the equivalent of, and to focus on the demands and needs of local citizens. You know, they want people, the police, to deal with burglaries, thefts, crime, rape, sexual offences, all of the kinds of things that everybody else deals with. But the Met constantly goes from disaster to disaster, chaos to chaos. And I don't necessarily think, regardless of who takes over, that it'll change overnight.
I'd be interested to hear of your view around the politicisation of policing today. So the UK police force had a unique structure, which was the police, the Home Office, the Home Secretary, and the police authority. That was done away with when they brought in the Police and Crime Commissioner. And of course, the Police and Crime Commissioner, for the very first time, brought a political element, because it was police and crime commissioners who were by and large sitting with a party. There are some independents, but by and large, they were sitting with a party. That, by its very nature, brings in a political element to policing. And of course, the Chief Constable is answerable in relation to the Police and Crime Commissioner in terms of how he spends their money, not in terms of how they do their policing, but in terms of how they spend their money. That doesn't seem to have helped.
Well, I mean, I was Chief Executive of the Police and Crime Commissioners a few years ago, and so I know what it's capable of doing. I don't think it's doing what it's capable of doing. The idea was that when you've got £9 billion policing budget nationally, and you know the Met itself is £2 billion, when you've got that kind of money being spent, the local priorities should be engaged with, that there should be a local plan dealing with local issues, and that the way you do that is by bringing this level of accountability in relation to priority setting and budgets, and the Police and Crime Commission should do that. In some cases, it's very effective. For example, the Bedfordshire Police and Crime Commissioner right now has put some really good things in place around ensuring that the and he's conservative, ensuring that the communities are represented and their priorities are being listened to and dealt with. One of the downsides of this new process, by the way, though, is that the Police and Crime Commissioners, when their Chief Constable leaves, more often than not replace them with the current Deputy Chief Constable or an assistant, you know. So what used to happen, Mark, was that, you know, a Chief Constable from, Deputy from the North would become the Chief of the South. There was some great movement of talent and ability around the country. That doesn't happen so much now. Police and Crime Commissioners, some of them just pick their favourites. And people they've already worked with, rather than thinking about something new or something brought in. So I've got no particular concern with the system as it currently is. I think the Police and Crime Commissioners was a very good idea in being able to bring some local accountability into policing. I just don't think it's been implemented very well. And I think also that some of them have decided, by appointing people they know into these chief roles, that they've actually diluted the talent pool. And we've spoken before, the talent pool isn't very big anyway. There's only about 50. You can only be a chief constable if you're a current deputy or assistant commissioner in London. So only 50 people can apply for 43 jobs, which is, you know, you've got a pretty good chance of getting one if somebody leaves. We need a bigger talent pool. And we need to look at the retired officers. We need to look at abroad, international talent being brought in. And I think that's one way of being able to bring in something new, which I think we need.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a major problem within police forces, where DCCs primarily step up to the role of the chief, where, of course, they've been instrumental in structuring the policing for the chief constable as it is. So there was an article, and Peter Hitchens, whatever one thinks of him, has written in the Mail today. He's argued that policing's doing it wrong. It's nothing to do with numbers. He argues that police should be on foot patrols and they would solve crime. Well, that for me is a fairly uneducated approach to the whole issue, because of course policing has changed, and what we know
crime has changed
absolutely, and what we know from foot patrols, and I was trying this morning to find the statistic, but it's a tiny statistic where police officers walking the beat will actually deter or come across a crime.
Exactly.
And of course, policing now has changed to very much being behind closed doors, certainly offending, to being online. But one of the things that is absolutely right is that we've got to change the style of policing. We've got to make it two-level policing. We've got to work on the basis that, yes, we can do community policing, and we should take away the responsibility of some of those officers from doing other crimes. And I still wonder whether... it's not a wonder, actually. We definitely need a full review, because policing has changed to such a degree now that I think we police sometimes the wrong things.
Well, no, in 2019, the government at the election promised us a Royal Commission on Criminal Justice. Where are we now? 2022. It still hasn't happened. It hasn't even started. Absolutely. We need a root and branch look at what quality of policing should be. What type of policing do we want? You're right about that. The idea that police officers walking down the street will stop crime when so much crime happens indoors or online. Well, how are they going to stop any of that, by walking down the street? There is a place for community policing. There's a place for neighborhood policing, but the model right now is not fit for purpose. It needs that root and branch review in order for us to determine in the 21st century, we're coming up in 2029, the 200th anniversary of the Metropolitan Police, the Robert Peel setting it up. So here's an opportunity. Let's put it out there to the government, any government, that by 2029, so we will have the brand new model for the third century of policing, rather than the model that we've adopted or adapted for the last two centuries, and get the public involved. I really do think that we're just tinkering. We've been tinkering for far too long. Police officers are suffering. Morale is really poor. Really low. Crime has migrated and changed into all sorts of different models now, but policing hasn't.
But there seems to be an ignorance and a stubbornness by the policing minister and other people to actually say, do you know what? What we need to do is properly grab a hold of this, get a proper review and say, we need to change policing. We need to look at the way we respond to policing, because it's not working. You know, we've now got the Metropolitan Police for the very first time in its whole history in special measures, other police forces in special measures. It is not working. What does it take for the policing minister and other ministers to finally wake up and say, we now need to change. We need to grab hold of this by the neck, because ultimately the public are the very people that we need to keep safe, and they're not being kept safe.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. They push it. They keep pushing it back into the long grass. They don't want to grasp it. There is a mechanism by which you can bring about the change. They don't want to. And in the meantime, crime continues to grow in the darkness. As we've said before, 50% of crime now uses the internet, and yet we don't have the means to do that. The police aren't resourced to deal with that. Rape and prosecutions are at an all-time low. There's a catalogue, and unfortunately, when you have, as we currently have, a cost of living crisis, crime goes up. That's always been the case. So we got the perfect storm of a system that isn't coping, add to that an increase in crime. I despair.
Well, Nazir, as ever, it's always great to speak to you. Our thoughts go out, as always, when we do our podcasts, which are very, very victim-focused, to the many victims of R. Kelly. And we hope that they get some resolve in the finally him going to court and going to jail for a very long time. If you are following us, please do drop us a message. Do let us know what you think of our podcast. So we're back now fortnightly, and we will, over the forthcoming months, give you different insight into crimes. And by doing that, we're going to get some guests on to start to talk about cases either they've dealt with or things that are of specific interest to them. So Nazir, look after yourself.
You too.
As ever, take care. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.